simply not going to work. The idea that we can develop in a world with enormous inequality between countries and putting millions of drones in the middle to prevent people from coming, you know, it's just not going to work. It's not only unfair, it's completely unrealistic. But I think, you know, what's key is to show there's enough money for everyone. You know, by moving in the direction of wealth redistribution, you can have resources for investment in Germany and France, and you can have resources at the same time for investment in the South. You know, there's a lot of resources that is not being well invested. And it's about changing the system of investment and taking back control of some of the investment choices that are being made. But, you know, it's an intellectual battle, and we let conservatives claim that, you know, 2% wealth tax is radical, which, of course, it is not. It is not radical, and, you know, we are going to need much bigger wealth tax and much bigger wealth redistribution in order to confront our climate challenge and social challenges, both in the South and in the North.
Well, hello and welcome to the Dissents podcast. I'm your host, Lukas Ondrejka, and this week my guest is Thomas Piketty. Together with a global team, the renowned economist recently published a report that models the path towards a just global economic order. The Global Justice Report shows how the social and ecological transition that we so desperately need could be done. Basically, by massively taxing the uber-rich and transferring the power over corporations towards a collectively owned fund that would invest in public and sustainable goods, both in the global North and South. Thomas Piketty joins me here on the Dissents podcast to talk about the details of the report and how socialists can win the battle for the hearts and minds in times of regression. So, let's get started. Mr. Piketty, thank you so much for joining me here on the Dissents podcast. Thank you.
My pleasure.
All right, let's talk Global Justice Report. Yes, Mr. Piketty, you just recently, together with 45 authors from across the globe, you published the Global Justice Report, which can only be described as a crazy comprehensive blueprint for a new global economy that would, on the one hand, raise the living standard for the majority of the people across the globe, not only in the Global South, but also to a majority of people in the Global North, while at the same time preventing climate overshoot, like limiting CO2 emissions to the extent that we don't reach over 2 degrees Celsius. And all that's done by massively taxing the uber-rich and curbing their power and redirecting resources towards climate transition and social transition. Maybe for starters, Mr. Piketty, a bit about the backdrop of the report, because I feel like the report is like a pinnacle of 10 years of your own research, but also collaborative research regarding inequality and climate research and the combination of those two. And it comes at a time of like really the opposite of escalating extremes. Like we see the climate overshoot in the beginning. We see escalating inequality. We see fascism on the rise. So maybe give us a bit of the backdrop of the report from your point of view and maybe summarize the core argument for our listeners. Yeah.
You know, I think this is because we live in a time of dystopia, you know, in some ways that we need to put, you know, positive utopian thinking back on the stage, you know. So I think, you know, what we're proposing in a way, you know, is some kind of utopia, but, you know, at the end of the day, I think it's a more, not only more desirable, but also in some ways more realistic utopian futures than the kind of dystopian futures that the techno-nationalist, if we want to summarize this way, because, you know, I think the term fascist is sort of too loaded in interwar period. And, you know, what we have in front of us is more specific than this. We have an ideology which basically is saying at the same time we are going to solve all the problem with technology and capitalism, capitalist-driven technology. And at the same time, they don't believe their own argument. So they, in fact, they try to use the tool of nationalism and militarized nationalism. And so the kind of dystopian discourse that we have in front of us in its most extreme form in particular the Trumpist form, you know, looks a lot like a return of colonial extractivism in its most brutal manner. You know, if you listen to what Trump is saying, he's basically saying, okay, we don't have enough resources to keep living as we do, so we're going to put the military on the table and grab all the oil from the rest of the world. So we're going to keep extracting oil, you know, of course. And we're not only we're going to keep extracting our own oil and gas in the U.S., but we are going to grab the oil of Venezuela, the oil of Iran, the minerals of Greenland, of Ukraine, all over the place. And, you know, if you listen to Trump, you know, what he's saying is basically, too bad that my public opinion is not following me entirely. You know, otherwise I will take control of the entire oil fields of Iran. So, okay, so this is the kind of discourse that we have in front of us. And it's not just theoretical, because these are people, you know, who are at the top of the most powerful military of the world and state apparatus of the world. So, you know, in front of that, you know, I think first, it's important to not only to react, but, you know, to propose some alternative view of the future so that we stop just talking about Trump and complaining about Trump and talk about something else, a more, you know, desirable future. And also, I would like to say, you know, to begin with, that as compared to this kind of dystopian narrative, our utopian narrative, you know, it looks almost reasonable, you know, even in terms of realism, you know, because I think, you know, the view that Trump is proposing to his citizen and to the world is not only reactionary, it's completely unrealistic. You know, the view that, you know, the public opinion of the U.S. or the Western world is going to follow him in some kind of neo-colonial extractivism, using the military to grab all the resources in the world. You know, he lives mentally, you know, this belongs to, you know, pre-World War One colonial ideology. You know, this is completely out of touch, including with the U.S. public opinion, because, you know, even if the U.S. public opinion is not easy to deal with, you know, I don't think they are ready to sign for this kind of platform. So anyway, just to say that we live in a sort of ideological vacuum, because you have this very extreme techno-nationalist discourses which are not going to deliver what they claim they do. And then, you know, there's no sort of clear alternative vision of where we want to go. And, you know, you have lots of people, in particular in Europe, who are still caught into some kind of what they believe to be centrist, free market thinking, which I think is not centrist at all, because, you know, I think the relying entirely on free trade and capitalist forces and market competition to solve our problem and trying to go back to the liberal order, which we tend to magnify, you know, as if, you know, it has, you know, in fact, it's always been a pretty brutal order, you know, at the time of George Bush and the Iraq war, you know, the discourse maybe was less brutal than that of Trump, but the reality in terms of sending, tens of thousands of soldiers on the ground, again, largely for, you know, to grab oil and, you know, for reasons related to the quest over resources and energy supply in particular, you know, it was already quite brutal, if not even more brutal than today. So, you know, this idea that we just need to wait and for, you know, the crazy Trump to go away and go back to the liberal order of the past, you know, I think is another illusion which is not going to solve any of the challenges. So, and then, you know, the left, you know, is, you know, has very different aspiration, but I think most people on the left don't really try to formulate, you know, the sort of alternative development path they have in mind. So, you know, the ideas that we put forward in this report are certainly not new in any meaningful manner. You know, when we talk about the return you know, social progress, increasing the labor share, reducing the working time, getting more public control over investments through sovereign fund, compressing the distribution of income and wealth. You know, all these ideas are already there, and to a large extent, they are in fact in the continuation of some of the long-run trend that happened over the 20th century with a general move toward more equality and more prosperity, which already happened in the past. So we just, you know, what's new in our report is simply that we try to put on the table a fully quantified proposal at the level of the world, where we sort of continue this path. If we can do it even faster and at an even larger scale, we are all for it. But what we are describing in our baseline scenario is a relatively gradual and, we believe, moderate, maybe too moderate, transition path toward more equality and more sustainability at the same time. The only novelty is that we are putting this fully quantified transition path on the table, not because we believe we have the ultimate truth about, you know, what path should be followed, but because we want, you know, to contribute to a discussion on a sort of precise quantified basis, so that then, you know, you don't like the scenario, you can change it. We have put online all the computer code series. We have a scenario explorer. So if people go on the Global Justice Project website, you know, they can change all the parameters they want. They can accelerate the trend. They can change the sectoral composition. What's new, just to summarize, is that as compared to the IPCC report on climate change, you know, we try to put inequality and social class at the center of our thinking about climate scenario. Mm. You know, the climate scenario that are analyzed in IPCC report, even the most desirable and sort of sustainable scenario, they don't talk enough about inequality. First, even inequality between countries is sort of a little bit under the carpet. You know, even the most sustainable and scenario based on accelerated convergence between countries. In fact, if you look at it carefully, by 2100, sub-Saharan Africa and South Asia have only one-third of the per capita GDP of Europe. So you're still quite far from convergence. And of course, it's easier to stay below 2 degrees if the biggest population in the world remain three times poorer than Europe. So we are much more explicit about a target of equality between countries, because we believe there's an aspiration of poor countries to develop and to reach the same kind of level of prosperity as the North, which is legitimate and is not going to go away, whatever we think in the North. And so that's our starting point. And we are more explicit about this equality target than IPCC. And next, IPCC report scenario analysis, you know, tends to completely ignore inequality within country. You know, they treat each country as sort of one macroeconomic aggregate, which of course is at the origin of many of our problems today. Because, you know, if you explain to the middle class or the lower income groups in Germany or France that they will have to pay huge additional taxes to for the climate transition, to help the global south, etc., you know, that's not going to work. You know, nobody in Germany or France or in the north is going to accept that. So if you don't put inequality and an explicit modeling of top wealth group, middle wealth group, bottom wealth group, if you don't have an explicit modeling of the full distribution from the very bottom to the very top, in order to be very explicit about who's going to pay for what, you end up in a situation which is a little bit the situation we have today, which is a sort of ecological backlash where nobody wants to hear anymore about the climate transition. But you know, our strong belief is that this is the consequence of this illusion of what we call classless ecology, you know, the idea that you can talk about the environment without talking about social class. And this is the illusion that we are, you know, trying to contribute to dismantle.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Mr. Piketty, for starters. There's so much to talk about, obviously. First, I have to say, and I encourage everybody to read the report. I'm going to link that in the show notes. And because it's really super comprehensive and the math is brilliant. So it presents kind of a clear-cut alternative vision to what you call techno-nationalist dystopia that we are steering towards already. And we're going to talk about whether it caught, from your perspective, some traction within the left, because it might suit as kind of a, at least global economic program, not especially for the national or local context, but in a global sense, an umbrella for a new coalition. So, but we're going to talk about that later. First, I wanted to get like a little sense from you how to achieve, through what kind of institutional mechanisms to achieve such a beneficial future when it comes to carbon emissions, but also when it comes to equality. I mean, one has to imagine it like a program that compresses wealth in so far as we have like really a true global middle class in the end, yeah, where income and wealth is converging to that point at least. And billionaires or even trillionaires now, we have like Elon Musk, they would pay for it and their wealth share would drastically drop. And we talk about funding and the battle around the issue of taxation maybe later. But maybe first about the institutional mechanism, because you not only propose the radical democratization of existing institutions on a global level when it comes to financial, the financial and the trade system, but also you put forward new international institutions, and first and foremost, the Global Justice Fund. Yeah, maybe talk about why is it not enough to transform existing institutions, make them more democratic? Right now, of course, they're plutocratic. But why do we need like new institutions, and maybe elaborate a bit what the Global Justice Fund would look like? Yeah.
Yeah, maybe let me first start by describing a little more the target in terms of development model and what kind of prosperity we want to reach. And then I tell you how the Global Justice Fund can do that.
Yeah.
You know, the objective that, you know, what the general questions we're trying to ask in the report is it possible for all countries in the world, in particular countries from the global south, to reach the same level as prosperity as the north by 2100? And if so, what should this level of prosperity, common level of prosperity, look like? So we set 2100 as a target because that's typically what climate projection set as a target. But, you know, if we can get equality and sustainability before that, we are all for it. You know, if people want to need more time to get to equality, why not? But, you know, you cannot say equality between countries is for 2500. You know, you have to you know, to explain a little bit what's your view of the world. You know, there's an aspiration to prosperity in India, in sub-Saharan Africa, in Latin America, which is legitimate. There's no reason why children based in these countries, you know, should be poor forever. So let's try to be consistent and propose a vision for the future. So today, if you look at average income in the world, you know, gross national income per capita ranges from about 200 euros per month, 250 euros per month in the world's poorest countries in sub-Saharan Africa, 300, 400, 500 in South Asia, all the way to almost 5,000 euros per month in the United States, about 4,500 euros per month. So that's all in purchasing power parity euro. If we are looking at market exchange rate, the gaps will be even bigger. But basically, there's a gap of 1 to 20, say between 250 euros per month and 5,000 euros per month between the poorest world region, sub-Saharan Africa, and the richest world region, say the US. And Europe is just a little bit below the US. The target that we are trying to explore for the long run is it possible to get all countries to 5,000 euros per month? So basically, all the countries in the global south will reach the level of prosperity of the US today, and the richest country will sort of stay basically at this level of 5,000 euros. So that's our baseline target. Now, if we also look at scenario where all countries will reach even higher levels, you know, up to 10,000 euros per month, that's possible under certain conditions, but this will be with an exploding planet and, you know, like 4 degrees or 4.5 degrees global warming, according to our projection. Mm. We also look at scenario with much lower target, you know, it could be 3,000 euros per month, 2,000, 1,000, which would include very important absolute degrowth in rich countries. And we argue that this may not be necessary, and that 5,000 euro per month might be compatible with planetary habitability and in particular global warming below 2 degrees, but only if it comes with very strong conditions. And so these conditions basically are, first, we need a very strong decarbonization, of course, of energy system. If poor countries today reach the same level as prosperity of the US with the same energy system, and in particular with fossil fuel, that's clearly not going to work in terms of climate projection. So decarbonization of energy system is key, and this requires enormous investment in renewable energy infrastructure at the level of the world. Second condition is what we call sufficiency, which we means a structural transformation of the sectoral distribution of economic activity. So this includes the continuation of the reduction in working time, which has been very important historically, in order to limit our material footprint. And in particular in rich countries today, the idea is that most productivity gains in the future will go to work time reduction. And we can talk more about the magnitude of this work time reduction, but we argue that, this is in line with the historical record. This will require strong mobilization and collective action, but this is not completely different from what was achieved in the past. The second dimension of sufficiency is transition from material to immaterial sector. So, smaller share for manufacturing goods, construction, and a much bigger share in immaterial sector like education, health, which are not completely immaterial, but which have a material footprint per euro of GDP, which is much smaller than the material sector. And so that's why this is so important.
So it would mean like degrowth for certain sectors like the car manufacturers and more public transportation and then growth in sectors like health and education.
Yeah, exactly. So, in our baseline projection, we have, almost 45% of labor hours in education, health and public services in all countries by 2100, Today, it's less than 10% in the poorest country of the world. But it's already 30-35% in countries like Sweden and Norway. So, our target of about 45%, 43% exactly in 2100 might actually be insufficient given aging, given the fact that, more and more young adults go to higher education. The transition to this immaterial sector maybe should be even bigger than this. But that's what we have in our baseline target. The third dimension of what we call sufficiency is also a change in food habits so as to reduce, the red meat consumption and allow for massive reforestation at the world level. Hmm. So that's in broad terms what we mean by sufficiency. And this is absolutely necessary to have both, the decarbonization of the energy system and sufficiency at the same time. And the third component after decarbonization of energy system and sufficiency is the compression of inequality. Why is this so important? Well, because we need to pay for massive investment in climate infrastructure, in education and health. And you want to make sure that, at least the bottom 90% of the population or even more is not going to have loss in their monetary income. So especially in the global north where aggregate growth is going to be capped to a large extent in the future, according to our baseline scenario, the compression of inequality is very important to make sure that even though average, aggregate income is capped, the bottom 90% of the population in the US or in Germany or in France still benefit from rising monetary income. Yeah. So these are the baseline description of our plan.
Yeah, totally. This is so central actually to argue that there could be enough for everyone and that we can actually have a prosperous life within planetary limits, but only if we do something about the uber rich. Yeah. By the way, Mr. Piketty, I hear a siren. So would you mind closing the window? Yes. Yeah. Thanks. So yeah, Mr. Piketty, all of that, of course, sounds amazing. The majority of the people better off, less time spent with labor and an intact planet, actually. And in times where people can't imagine a better future, oftentimes, but only dystopia, I saw myself printing out the report and having it with me all the time. And if somebody said, yeah, but actually, how would we do it? What would be the alternative? I would like just beat them around the head with the report and give it to them. Just read it. But yeah, now maybe turn towards how we get there and why it's important to also have like new institution. We weren't going to talk about the World Sovereign Fund shortly after, like the most important institution, the Global Justice Fund. And given the time, keep it brief. How would the Global Justice Fund work and why do we need a new institution in times where multilateralism is actually at a low? Yeah.
Well, you know, we countries from the global north have made commitments, you know, to pay for climate adaptation and for climate reparation. You know, they've made commitments at the time of the Paris summit in 2015. They've made repeated commitments in various summits, except that, you know, the money is still not there. And I think, you know, the reason why the money, the corresponding resources have not been put on the table is simply that, you know, countries in the north, you know, they cannot ask average middle-class taxpayer or lower-income taxpayer in Germany or France to pay for that. So the Global Justice Fund, you know, is proposing explicitly to pay for that with a global wealth tax, a global income tax that will target basically the top 1% of the world. And then the Global Justice Fund will do two things, will distribute part of the money as what we call country dividends, which will be per capita amount. You know, every country will get the same per capita amount, which could be used to invest in climate infrastructure, in education, in health. And, you know, our scenario, the per capita amount will reach about 2,000 euros per capita by 2030, and will stay there and will be, you know, between 1,000, 2,000 euros per capita in the following decade, which, you know, it's not enormous, but, you know, it's still, you know, around 5% of world GDP. You know, today, total development aid is about 0.3% of world GDP. And you know, sometimes it pays Western consultant more than money directly useful for the country. So, you know, it's a much bigger scale. And also, you know, it's relying a lot more on country, you know, government and decentralization, which we think is important, although, you know, it comes with conditions. But then, you know, we want to make sure that the money is really used for climate, education and health, starting from a situation today where, you know, the per capita budget in education or in health in sub-Saharan Africa, you know, it's less than 100 euros per capita, you know, as compared to 50 times more or 80 times more in Europe or in North America, 5,000 euros per capita, 8,000 euros per capita. So we start from a situation of such low resources, you know, in the poorest country of the world that, you know, this country dividend would make a difference. They would also make a difference in countries like Germany and France because everybody would receive this country dividends per capita. And then the other objective of the Global Justice Fund would be to put some of its resources into what we call the World Sovereign Fund, which would be a sovereign fund, you know, think of the Norwegian Sovereign Fund, which is much bigger at the level of the Norwegian GDP than what we have in mind at the level of the world. But this, in effect, you know, this would mean that a substantial part of the wealth tax paid by billionaires and millionaires in the future will be put, you know, in effect, they will transfer some of their shares, some of their portfolio into a public sovereign fund, which then will be able to gradually reorient world investment in the direction of sustainability. So, you know, when you receive the shares from the billionaires and the millionaires, you know, you could decide to do nothing at all, you know, to keep the same portfolio. You know, but that's important to start from that because sometimes, you know, people say, you know, billionaires, millionaires, they don't have the cash to pay for a big wealth tax. But, you know, they don't need to have cash. You know, they can just transfer their assets. They just need, that's what we want. We want to change the control of investment. So, you know, you just transfer your shares. You could change nothing at all if you want, could keep the same portfolio. But of course, it will be better to gradually reorient investment in the direction of sustainability. So maybe you will put less resources into building data centers all over the world and more resources, renewable energy infrastructure, public transport, whatever you want. And this is how the Global Justice Fund, both by giving country dividends and by creating this public sovereign fund to reorient a substantial part of world investment, will be able to achieve its goal over time.
Yeah, thank you. There are so many questions I have, but the time is running. So just one regarding the World Sovereign Fund. I mean, I regard it as well as super important to go beyond standard redistribution debates, which mainly focus on taxation, tax revenues or tax evasion. But we also have to talk about what you rightfully called like controlling the investments, the public investments and divestments, for example, from fossil fuels. And for that, something like the World Sovereign Fund, which dilutes private ownership of companies gradually and puts more weight towards public ownership, it's very important. And it's great that you put something like this forward. But you propose like holding 10 to 20% of companies like globally, like a minority share. Why not 51%? I mean, in the past, you argued for participatory socialism, where you argued for, making it mandatory to give half of the seats on a company board to workers in order to like really get to a social change, but also make it even possible to think ecological transformation. So I don't see 10 to 20% to cut it. And the other thing would be, how would such a body be governed? Because we see like in the case of the Norwegian State Fund, which by the way is funded by fossil fuel extraction, that's one thing. And it benefits also from the exploitation of workers all across the world. And another thing is that the drive for profit, when you look at the decisions of the ethical board or the decisions of the ethical board being trumped by the parliament, for example, in Norway, the drive for profit there is regarded much higher than ethical standards like human rights or ecological standards. And we see that, for example, when it comes to the occupation of Palestinian territories, there was a question if they withdrew money from Caterpillar, which is part of like the Israeli onslaught in Gaza, for example, and they decided it was more important to further invest into Caterpillar. And the other thing is like divestments from fossil fuels, from big companies or from big tech companies, where the profit margin is also regarded higher than ethical standards. So there's like this question how to design something like this democratically. For example, think about an independent public agency, which is comprised not only of workers, but also of other stakeholders and not of state bureaucrats that or only politicians that are in cahoots with moneymakers. So, so these are my two questions, like why only a minority holding in the report and what about the hindrances for ethical investments? Yeah.
Yeah, so let me try to answer this. So let me say very clearly that, the creation of this World Sovereign Fund, should be viewed as part of a much broader platform, to transform the development model and in particular the property regime. And so this is not supposed to stop there. What I call in my own work participatory socialism, is still part of the equation and the objective, and it is mentioned several times in the report. So let me take your question one by one. First, about the size of the World Sovereign Fund itself. We set as the target 60% of world GDP, which will be about 10% of world capital stock, because the capital stock is about 500%, 600% of GDP, 5-6 years of output. So 10% of the capital stock, you know, this can look like a modest number where, you know, in, so that nobody is frightened. In fact, you know, it's quite ambitious because you have to keep in mind that, you know, in the total capital stock, about half of it is housing. So in fact, when it's 10% of the total capital stock, if you don't own that much in housing, it's actually 20% of business assets and other assets. So it gives you, you know, very significant leverage potentially and investment flows. So this is smaller. If we take the Norwegian sovereign fund, you know, it is now much bigger. You know, it's over 400% of Norwegian GDP. It's actually more than private wealth in Norway, which shows at least, you know, that you can have a very large public share in total ownership and, you know, things don't, the world does not collapse immediately. Now, that doesn't mean that we take the Norwegian sovereign fund as a model. You know, if you look at the investment policy of the Norwegian sovereign fund, you know, it's certainly not perfect. I mean, the origin of the fund, as you mentioned, is problematic. You know, it comes from the extraction of fossil fuels, which should not have been extracted to begin with. So in our case, you know, we develop sovereign fund by taxing billionaires and millionaires, which we believe is a much better way. And some of these billionaire millionaires, of course, became rich by you know, through fossil fuel extraction directly or indirectly through the investment choices they have made. And, you know, this is why they have now such a big responsibility for total emission and climate change. And this is why we believe, you know, it's perfectly legitimate to transfer, you know, a large part of their asset to a sovereign fund. Mm. So this is a better way than Norway to create a sovereign fund. And the investment policy of the fund, you know, should be a lot more satisfactory than Norwegian. Now, the Norwegian sovereign fund, if you look at what they do in terms of investment policy, it's probably better than the sovereign fund of Saudi Arabia, of Qatar, if you look at the sustainability criterion or even the labor criterion, probably because, you know, at least there's some kind of democratic parliamentary oversight by the Norwegian parliament, which is not perfect, but, you know, as compared to other sovereign funds of other oil countries, that's still a little bit better, but we could do a lot better. And, you know, what this experience shows is that the governance and, you know, the democratic construction that comes with it is really key. And so having more direct citizen oversight, workers oversight over the sovereign fund, you know, is something that remains to be invented. Mm. Now, should the total size of the sovereign fund be even larger than this? Why not? You know, we have a discussion about this in the report. You know, we are perfectly open to this. What we stress in the report is that this is more like a minimum in order to reorient investment in the right direction. But in our view, this should come with a broader transformation of the property regime. In particular, we very much argue several times in the report in favor of more workers' involvement in the governance of all companies, whether they are partly owned by the sovereign fund or not. And in particular, you know, we have this objective that I mentioned in my previous work of having, you know, at least 50% of voting shares in the board of companies going directly to workers' representative. Yeah. If we want to, which is something which sort of exists in Germany with large companies, except that shareholders have the, you know, the decisive vote and they are very often able to split the workers so as to keep control. And so what we suggest to do in order to go further this imperfect model is to limit the voting rights of large shareholders. For instance, you know, they could be limited to 10% of voting rights in companies with more than 100 employees so that we have a more participatory governance. And, you know, this comes more generally with an objective of a general, you know, pursuing a general process of decommodification of the economy where, you know, more democratic decision making, more, you know, labor friendly, environmental friendly standards are playing the key role in investment decisions. So the objective is not to replace, you know, greedy billionaires by a greedy sovereign fund and greedy workers who own all own a share of their company. This is really to change, to transform the way investment decisions are made. So the plan comes with, in our baseline projection, with a very significant increase in the labor share of the entire economy and a significant decline of the profit share, which means that the rate of return on capital will decline. And we, what we discuss also in the report is that, you know, it could decline even further, which will mean less resources for the sovereign fund. But that's okay, because if this lower return come with the achievement of higher environmental objective and social objective by better investment decisions, then, you know, you need less resources to be transmitted as country dividends after that. So, you know, we are very, if you look at the way we describe these different options, you know, we are very open, and everything that can accelerate the process of decommodification of the economy and democratization of the economy, and in effect, getting out of the capitalist logic as quickly as possible and move to some new form of democratic socialism. You know, we are all for it. You know, and that's clearly the road we indicate in the report. Now, we don't want to say, you know, each country has to transform its property regime, the voting rights for workers, exactly like this, because, you know, I think we, this is an area where we need collective experimentation. You know, I have made some proposal about participatory socialism with some specific formula for voting rights for workers. But, you know, I'm not going to claim that this is the only possible way to reach, you know, participatory socialism. So in the report, we clearly take a stand in favor of this model, but, you know, we don't say, okay, every country should do exactly this in 2035. So we are more precise about the size, the minimum size of the sovereign fund, the minimum size of the global wealth tax, global income tax. But it's more, for us, it's more a minimum than you know, an objective in itself. We hope it can trigger a process where we will go much further.
Yeah. I mean, it's a starting point for a discussion, first of all. Just one quick follow-up question regarding the socialist or revival of a socialist debate. I see your proposal kind of like a shareholder socialism, though that might be the question how something like the Swedish might not plan from the 1970s or the revival of that could combine with this model of a world sovereign fund. But we leave that aside or for further discussion at some other point. But regarding like the revival of the democratic planning debate, yeah, in France as well, with people like Cédric Durand, and here in Germany as well, because I see the proposal of the Global Justice platform kind of like a market socialism, correct me if I'm wrong, but a market socialism in its infancy. And I wondered whether there is also a place for democratic planning in your proposal, or how you view the discussion around democratic planning. Because in your report, you hint towards monetary accounting, but also material accounting. And there might be points where we need to, yeah, withhold stuff from the market or not make it market-based. So your quick thought on the democratic planning debate and whether that could be incorporated or be part of that discussion around the Global Justice Project. Yeah.
Very quickly, I think our plan is more a plan for democratic socialism than market socialism. But, you know, okay. So democratic planning, you know, is certainly something that could take place in a democratically governed sovereign fund. But for us, it also needs to take place at the level of, you know, direct workers, election and involvement in the governing of companies and production unit in general, because in our plan, you know, there's a very strong shift, not only from material to immaterial sectors, but also from profit making units to non-profit making units, you know, in particular in education and health, you know, and that's in the continuation of a process of decommodification of the economy, which has already started. You know, in the past century, you have, you know, entire sectors, in particular in education and health, and to a lesser extent in transport, energy, culture, other sectors, which have developed outside the market logic, and in fact, very efficiently. You know, as we know, you know, the health sector, you know, is largely public in Europe, and it costs less than in the US, and is much more effective in terms of public health outcomes. So I think, you know, we have not only to be proud of this, but to continue in this direction. And our, with our big sectoral shift toward education and health, it means also the development of production units which are outside the profit logic. Now, this doesn't mean this has to be, you know, central planning with the government hiring the teachers and the nurses directly. You know, it can involve a lot of sort of decentralized, democratic decision making at the level of municipalities, at the level of hospitals, at the level of universities, at the level of local transportation system, energy system, biological food production, at the local level. You know, it's for us, you know, the plan, the Global Justice Report is completely consistent with, you know, all the very interesting proposals that have been made about, you know, moving out of the standard capitalist logic and going toward non-profit, decommodified economic model.
Yeah, thank you so much. I'm really looking forward to the discussion. Maybe one question regarding the feasibility of the Global Justice Platform, the fund and the World Sovereign Fund. It's hard to imagine the Global Justice Platform or any similar platform. And in the report, you hint towards like platforms that already exist with kind of similar goals or a shared perspective, at least. It's kind of hard to imagine such a platform to be adopted by all countries all at once. So even though that's would be cool, but given the existing power relation and divides, this seems kind of hard to imagine. At the same time, time is pressing. So is there a chance for any incomplete but large enough coalition of the willing that could do something like this? And would it be possible without the US and without China, maybe, if Europe and the Global South, for example, did something like this? And how could that work? How could they sanction, for example, like Trump and his tech billionaire class that is withdrawing kind of, but needs those markets, I guess? A quick answer to that.
Yeah, we try to describe in the report, you know, the kind of incomplete coalition which could gradually implement the platform of the report. And yes, we don't need to start with the unanimity of country. And we believe that if a sufficiently large coalition starts, you know, at the end of the day, even the US and China, you know, will need to join this because, you know, the pressure, generally speaking, the pressure and the demand for climate reparation and economic justice coming from the Global South, you know, is going to be stronger and stronger in the future. And, you know, it's not a coincidence if the proposal for a global billionaire tax was first put by Brazil and South Africa on the table of G20 discussion. And, you know, this is going to be bigger and bigger. And as soon as India supports this kind of proposal, China, you know, will be happy to upset the West by supporting, you know, some countries in Europe will have to support it because it's also a way for them to get fiscal resources for them. So, you know, I think some incomplete coalition will have to develop. The international system today is highly unstable. You know, the fact that people in Washington are getting so nervous is firstly because they are losing control of the system. You know, the US as a share of world GDP used to be 40-45% in 1950, a little bit like Europe in 1910. Now it's only 15% and it's going to go down to 5-10% by the end of the century. So the US are losing control. Some of them want to solve the situation by putting the guns on the table. But you know, that's not going to work. And some of their worst problem, in particular their trade deficit, is due to the fact that, you know, they are now too small a share of world GDP to serve as an international reserve. You know, the fact that the dollar is still used as a reserve currency given that the US economy is now quite small and is going to get smaller and smaller at the world GDP, implies a huge overvaluation of the dollar as too many countries try to put reserve assets in the US. And that's what's creating the US trade deficit. So this will have to change. And the only solution, including from a US viewpoint, you know, is to move toward an international reserve currency, which will have to be a weighted average of dollar, euro, yuan. And, you know, I think we will be moving toward an international currency system, which in our global justice plan is also, you know, an important component of the plan. So, you know, the general answer is that, you know, the current system is just unsustainable. And therefore, you know, there, some change will happen. And, you know, we are not saying things are going to happen in the very orderly way we describe in the report. Things can be more chaotic. But what we know from history is that, you know, when crises happen and catastrophes happen, governments need to find solutions. And whatever was discussed before the catastrophe happened, you know, has a bigger chance to be adopted when catastrophes happen. And so that's all what we're trying to do. And, and there's already, just to mention one thing that is already happening, the UN Convention on International Tax Cooperation that is almost adopted. It will probably be adopted next year by a majority of countries in the world. You know, this is a group of the G77 non-aligned countries, but which now are actually 135 or 140 countries and have a huge majority in the UN General Assembly. They are about to adopt a UN tax convention, which then will create some governance bodies to take joint decisions about the international tax system. And, you know, what's very interesting is that, so European countries until now are just abstaining from the discussion. You know, they don't vote no, they don't vote yes, you know, very, you know, European style attitude. You have countries like the US and I think Argentina, who are voting, and maybe Israel are voting against, but, you know, nobody cares because they don't have a majority. And, you know, the interesting thing in this process about the UN, tax convention is that countries from the global south are now very clear about the fact that they want to move ahead without unanimity. They want to move ahead with a majority rule-based system. So as opposed to, you know, the famous UN Convention on Climate Change, for which we have this Conference of the Party, you know, COP in Paris and every year, which is entirely based on unanimity, with the consequence that it doesn't take any decision. And it makes nice statements every year, but, you know, it's not really taking any concrete financial decision. Mm. And I think what's happening right now with the UN tax convention is a form of democratic revolution at the level of the United Nations, which we should pay a lot more attention to in the North. You know, they meet, the UN tax convention delegates already meet regularly. You know, they will meet in Africa in next October. The media in Europe and North America almost don't talk about this, but this is incredibly important because, you know, at some point, they will take decision. And I think European countries, maybe not unanimously, maybe only part of European countries, but will have to join this process. And, you know, rich countries try to control tax coordination at the level of the OECD. But that's not possible. You know, this is not an issue just for rich countries. This is an issue for the entire world, including countries in the global south. And so this is why this UN tax convention process is so important. And, you know, I think gradually this could become something like the global justice fund that we are describing. So it's not, you know, what we are describing is not sort of a utopian story that is completely disconnected from existing political processes. I mean, to some extent, this is already happening a little bit. And, you know, we could see after the publication of the Global Justice Report, you know, I've been participating to many debates with people in India, in West Africa, in Latin America. You know, in the global south, there's a lot of appetite for this kind of discussion. I mean, in the north as well. And, you know, thank you for this opportunity. But, you know, I think the working class movement has been very important in the 19th and 20th century to bring change. Now, in the 21st century, you know, the proletariat of the world is in the global south. And so I think the driving political force, you know, is going to come from the global south. It will sometimes be chaotic. Look at what's happening as we speak in Ceuta at the Moroccan-Spanish frontier. It will not be easy. But at the end of the day, this powerful force for transformation coming from the global south, this very strong demand for economic justice, climate reparation, you know, will be impossible to resist for the North. And so we have to prepare ourselves to participate to the discussion. And, you know, in the end, you know, I think this is what will happen.
Hmm. Yeah. I mean, there's still the chance for more fascization or nationalism, but because that's why I think it's also important to really revive the labor and climate movement in the global North. And there are people working on that. As a lookout, because this platform, if it's getting more traction, or any labor and climate and justice platform is going to face fierce opposition. I mean, now it's about a 2% wealth tax that is discussed globally. And already there's fierce opposition to this by the billionaire class. And you propose a 20% wealth tax on billionaires. I don't know if that would make billionaires or trillionaires like Elon Musk obsolete, evaporate them, and we would only have centimillionaires. Maybe you can quickly say what that would mean, like, for the wealth of somebody like Elon Musk or Bernard Arnault or Dieter Schwarz in Germany. But yeah, the opposition is going to be fierce. And I just wonder, what's your thought on how to overcome this opposition? And this also regards the left. What kind of merit can discussing and putting forward such a platform, which is highly oriented towards global justice and towards climate action, what kind of merit could such a platform have for the left in the global North, which is struggling with the public opinion being highly skeptical towards climate, any climate policy, colonial mindsets regarding the global South, regarding migration and stuff like that, and being more occupied by issues which are on the local or national level? Stuff like rent explosions or the cost of living crisis or something like that. So I wonder, or at least it seems a bit counterintuitive for players like this, for a labor movement, for unions, for a party like Die Linke or France Insoumise to kind of adopt such a platform or actively push it. So I wonder what kind of place you see of this platform within this fight for emancipation in the global North or within the left.
Let me describe the wealth tax we're proposing as a top tax rate of 20% per year on billionaire and centimillionaire. So indeed, after a few years, if you pay 20% per year, you don't have billionaire or centimillionaire anymore. So in the wealth distribution we have in the longer run in our scenario, you know, the income scale is 1 to 5, and the wealth scale is 1 to 10. So it goes from, you know, let's say it will be per adult, it will go from, you know, in the long run from 200,000 euros to 1 million. So you will still have millionaire, but you won't have a deca millionaire and you won't have centimillionaire or billionaire. So that's the income scale and wealth scale we have. Now, this can seem quite radical, but in fact, what we argue is that, you know, if you look at the historical pattern, you know, the income scale 100 years ago in Western Europe and in Nordic Europe, if you look at the income scale between the bottom 10% and the top 0.1% in income, it was 1 to 150. And it has been reduced to 1 to 11, you know, in Nordic European countries over the course of the 20th century. And so the target which we set of 1 to 5 in the long run, you know, it's in the continuation, but it's not a very spectacular change in compared to what has been achieved already in the 20th century, at least for income compression. For wealth compression, it's a bit more, because, and that's why it requires progressive wealth taxation and not just progressive income taxation like what we have in the 20th century. Mm-hmm. But, you know, generally speaking, that's in the continuation. Now, you're telling me there will be a lot of resistance. That's for sure. But, you know, we should remember that after World War II, You had exceptional wealth tax, including in Germany, with top tax rate of 50%, you know, 50. And in France, you had a wealth tax in 1945 with a tax rate of 20%, up to 100% for largest enrichment, so people whose wealth had increased during the war. In Japan, you had a wealth tax with a top tax rate of 90% after World War II. Now, all these were adopted in countries with a democratic parliament and which were very successful in their post-war development strategy and reconstruction strategy, largely because they were able to build consensus about social justice, you know, by asking more to the people, you know, who had more wealth. Now, of course, this was a time where huge catastrophe had happened before, where there was very large public debt, very large investment needs for public infrastructure, public education. But, you know, in a way, that's a little bit like today. You know, we have enormous public debt, we have enormous investment needs, and we are in a situation, a political situation that's simply not working. You know, the alliance between center-right and center-left that we have in Germany or, you know, in Britain or whatever, you know, are going nowhere. And you know, if you know, the only parties which seem to be proposing something new are the nationalist anti-migrant parties who claim they're going to solve the problem of Europe by sending back migrants to Africa and putting millions of drones in the Mediterranean to prevent them from coming to Europe. You know, this is the kind of development model that the European nationalists are proposing us. You know, this is, in a way, this is even more crazy than the US techno-nationalists, you know, who want to put data centers on the Mars planet. So, you know, the European nationalists, you know, in a way, are even more scary in their view of the future. And, you know, the common point between the two group of nationalist people is that it's actually not going to work. It's simply not going to work. The idea that we can develop in a world with enormous inequality between countries and putting millions of drones in the middle to prevent people from coming, you know, it's just not going to work. It's not only unfair, it's completely unrealistic. So, you know, as compared to these challenges, I would say, you know, the situation after World War II was not more cataclysmic. You know, it was, you know, there were big shocks, but we are also today facing big shocks. So now, how do we get there for countries in the north and particularly for political parties like Die Linke or LFI in France? I'm not saying it's easy, you know, but I think, you know, what's key is to show that, you know, there's enough money for everyone. Basically, there's enough resources. You know, by moving in the direction of wealth redistribution, you can have resources for investment in Germany and France, and you can have resources at the same time for investment in the South. You know, there's a lot of resources. There's a lot of resources that is not being well invested. And that's really the important point which you stressed before, is about, you know, it's not just about redistribution ex post. It's about changing the system of investment, changing the production structure, and taking back control of some of the investment choices that are being made. Mm. You know, there's a lot of resources that are currently being invested in luxury goods, data centers all over the place, military spending, you know, which, you know, I think there's a lot better use that could be done with the same resources. You know, if you think of the incredible resources that are being spent on data centers all over the place, you know, I think the needs in terms of well-being of you know, average citizens in Germany or France, you know, which will be much better addressed with investment in low carbon energy, transportation, health, education, etc. So it's really about showing public opinion in Germany and France that their sort of daily life and access to transport, to hospital, to public services could be improved by moving in this direction. But you know, it's primarily, it's an intellectual battle and cultural battle about what kind of development model do we want. You know, do we want to consume more and more material goods, or do we want this idea of targeted sufficiency, where, you know, when we have enough material goods, we can move on to education and health. it's about democratic control of the economy. And, you know, I think there are lots of people today on the left, but, you know, also on other sides of the political spectrum who feel that, you know, we are sort of lost democratic control over the economic system and we are waiting for a different kind of perspective. Mm. And, you know, it's an intellectual battle about not leaving economic discussion and financial discussion and fiscal discussion to a small group of conservative experts. You know, the idea that a 2% wealth tax is radical when we used 50% wealth tax or 90% wealth tax after World War II is just a sign of extreme historical ignorance, which, you know, is just not acceptable. You know, we have to, we forget even, you know, our own historical legacy of what was done in Germany or France or Japan after World War II. We completely forget about this and we let conservative claim that, you know, 2% wealth tax is radical, which of course it is not. It is not radical. And, you know, we are going to need much bigger wealth tax and much bigger wealth redistribution in order to confront our climate challenge and social challenges, both in the South and in the North.
Mr. Piketty, thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ja, Leute, ich hoffe mal, euch hat das Gespräch mit Thomas Piketty getaugt. Das war jetzt nach Kuai Saito ja das zweite Gespräch in englischer Sprache in kürzester Zeit. Ich hoffe, das passt für euch. Wenn ich mal die Chance habe, so Leute zu sprechen, dann kann ich mir das natürlich nicht entgehen lassen. Und ja, ehrlich gesagt, hatte ich jetzt auch keine anderen Folgen in petto. Bei mir ist gerade alles ein bisschen tight mit 6 Monate altem Kind hier im Haushalt. Ja, ich hoffe, es war cool für euch, aber wenn nicht, wenn ihr sauer seid, wenn ihr wütend seid, dann schreibt mir doch gerne eine Mail, ne? dissenspodcast@posteo.de. Aber ich nehme natürlich auch ein bisschen Bauchpinseln, ist ja klar. Genau. Wenn ihr euch für das Global Justice Project oder den Report interessiert, dann schaut doch gerne mal in die Shownotes, da habe ich deren Seite verlinkt. Es gibt den Report in verschiedenen Sprachen, auch auf Deutsch. Wenn euch das interessiert, ihr da reinlesen wollt, ich kann es nur wärmstens empfehlen, dann macht das doch. So. Zum Schluss noch 2 Hinweise. Erstens, Dissens braucht dringend euren Support. Teilt diese Folge, erzählt vielen Leuten von diesem Podcast und wenn ihr könnt, dann werdet doch unbedingt Fördermitglied. Es ist die großartige Community von Fördermitgliedern, die mit ihren Beiträgen diesen Podcast hier möglich macht, dass ich Zeit hier reinstecke in Dissens und dass dieser Podcast für alle hörbar ist, kostenlos, werbefrei und unabhängig. Damit Dissens aber weiter gut in die Zukunft gehen kann, brauchen wir tatsächlich jetzt ein paar neue Fördermitglieder. Wenn du noch nicht dabei bist und du es dir gerade finanziell leisten kannst, es dir gerade reinpasst, dann mach doch jetzt mit. Nimm dir nach der Folge kurz Zeit, geh in die Shownotes oder auf dissenspodcast.de und schließe eine Fördermitgliedschaft ab. Ich sag schon mal Danke. Gut, soweit dazu und jetzt noch der 2. Hinweis. Wir nähern uns der Dissens-Sommerpause. Voraussichtlich am 12. August gibt es die letzte Folge Dissens vor der Sommerpause. Dann bin ich 4 Wochen raus und am 16. September, ich wiederhole, am 16. September wieder für euch am Start. In der Zwischenzeit geht ihr natürlich nicht leer aus, sondern es gibt 2 Folgen von der Was-Tun-Crew. Inken und Valentin fangen nach ihrer Elternzeitpause jetzt wieder an. Da dürft ihr schon gespannt sein. Und ich habe eine Folge mit Sebastian und Nils von Überrechts eingetütet. Die werden euch nach der Sachsen-Anhalt-Wahl, also Anfang September, eine kleine Nachwahlbesprechung machen. Ja, und vielleicht auch einen Ausblick wagen, was das jetzt für das Land bedeutet, die Ergebnisse. Also, no worries, es gibt auch in der Zeit meiner Abwesenheit, in der Zeit der Sommerpause, weiter was auf die Ohren. Alles klar, soweit dann erstmal an dieser Stelle von mir. Jetzt wünsche ich euch noch einen schönen Tag oder einen schönen Abend oder eine schöne Nacht. Und ja, wir hören uns dann wieder nächste Woche. Bis dann.